Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This summer marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of Nelson Mandela. He was an activist, a revolutionary, a political leader, and a philanthropist. He fought apartheid in South Africa and spent 27 years in prison before emerging to lead his country as South Africa's first black head of state and the first head of state to be elected in a fully representative democracy. He was honored, of course, with the Nobel Peace Prize, and his ideals and words have inspired millions. As people around the world have taken time this summer to honor his accomplishments and reflect on his legacy, we're going to spend some time this hour doing the same. And later in the hour, we'll meet three young professionals from Africa who spent time in Iowa this summer as part of the Mandela Washington Fellowship Program run by the U.S. State Department. My first guest today is Ambassador Ron McMullen. Before serving as ambassador to the state of Eritrea, he spent more than 30 years working for the U.S. Foreign Service and has lived and worked or traveled in 105 countries. He's now the University of Iowa's ambassador in residence, and he's originally from Northwood, Iowa. He received his PhD at the University of Iowa, and he also spent some time in South Africa when Nelson Mandela was president. Ambassador McMullen, thank you so much for being here today.
Good morning, Charity. My pleasure.
And let's talk about your time in South Africa. When were you assigned there?
My wife and I and our two sons lived in Cape Town, South Africa, from 1996 to 1999. Nelson Mandela had been elected president in 94, and so this was sort of midway through his term as president when everybody was very optimistic and the U.S. government very strongly supportive of South Africa and Nelson Mandela's leadership there.
It must have been a very exciting time to go to South Africa.
It was. And it was the bonds between the U.S. and South Africa were so close that every 6 months, half the U.S. cabinet came to South Africa and worked with their counterparts on issues of common concern. And the alternate 6 months, half the South African cabinet would go to Washington, D.C. and work alongside their counterparts for 6 months. Vice President Gore and Deputy President Thabo Mbeki were in charge of this. The relations were just unbelievably close.
One of the things that made Nelson Mandela such a remarkable leader was his focus on reconciliation. So many ugly things had happened in South Africa in the many years before he became president. Tell me a little bit about his leadership and how he was trying to bring such a damaged country together.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And it really helps explain Nelson Mandela's rise from sort of revolutionary prisoner to a Nobel Peace Prize winner and now kind of a democracy and humanity icon for the world. He had every reason to come out of his more than two decades of prison, bitter, vengeful, and seeking to even scores. He didn't. And why he didn't remains one of life's great joys and mysteries, because nothing in his background. He was raised in a rural part of the Eastern Cape in South Africa. His father was a pagan polygamist, kind of a minor tribal leader. He went to a Methodist high school and went to college, became revolutionized there, and became a student activist. Later was educated as an attorney and worked as an attorney, which I think gave him that foundation of the rule of law and his respect for the rule of law. But how he came out and why he became a man of reconciliation and peace and democracy after being a, you know, founding spear of the nation, the African National Congress armed wing, and advocating and promoting violent revolution in South Africa, really one of the world's great turnaround stories, really interesting.
Well, and he spent so many years in prison. So first, after seeing the injustice in South Africa and fighting against it, and then to be imprisoned for 27 right. years. Again, I mean, the fact that that yes. did not create this bitterness.
I saw Nelson Mandela on Robben Island at a dinner. It was a charity event to raise money for former political prisoners. And it happened to be when First Lady Hillary Clinton was in South Africa, along with First Daughter Chelsea. And this fundraising dinner was to take place on Robben Island, the prison island off of Cape Town. And when the First Lady's entourage found that this was happening while she was in South Africa, we got her tickets to attend along with Chelsea. And I was part of the small team that took her to Robben Island and showed her Nelson Mandela's cell and the quarry where he broke rocks for many of the years he was on this prison island. And when it was time for dinner, we took the Clinton women to the former warden's house, where they went in to have dinner with Nelson Mandela and the other guest, who had paid $57,000 a plate for this fundraiser. And somebody from the embassy and I were sitting on the outside on the hood of a Jeep that we had to get the Clinton women around the island. And we were looking for great white shark fins in the Atlantic there near Robben Island when there were a lot. So it was a perfect location for a prison island. And the organizer came out and said, Ron, we had a no-show. Would you like to go in and eat? And I said, I don't know. Do I have to pay? And she said, no, just go in. So I went in and sat next to Miss South Africa, which was kind of a treat. And Nelson Mandela was there and Hillary and Chelsea Clinton. And we had salmon or something as an appetizer. And at 9 o'clock, Nelson Mandela got up and said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm an old man. And wherever I am at 9 o'clock, I go home. So he got up to leave, and I realized that Hillary and Chelsea Clinton were going to leave on his helicopter, so I needed to get up and say goodbye to everybody and then get them to the helipad. And that was kind of symbolic, that Nelson Mandela knew when to say goodbye. He served one term, as he had promised to do. He could have been president for life. He could have started a Mandela dynasty. He was so popular. If you look at what happened in neighboring countries, Robert Mugabe came to power under a democratic transition and ruled for 37 years and ran his country right into the ground. In neighboring Angola, President Dos Santos also ruled for 38 years and turned his country into one of the most corrupt and authoritarian governments anywhere. Nelson Mandela knew when to go home. He, that night on Robben Island, when he said goodnight at 9 o'clock, and also, after serving 5 years of, as president, he stepped down when he could have remained president for life.
I hear echoes of George Washington in what
you're
saying.
Oh, very much so. Absolutely.
Was that his model?
I don't know if George Washington was his motto or not. But, you know, George Washington also had dealt with the transition of the U.S. military. The famous address at Newburgh, where the military came and complained, we haven't been paid, you know, we're going to do something about it. General Washington, what should we do? Nelson Mandela also was facing a very difficult transition in the South African military. It was during the apartheid period. It had largely been governed or run by white officers with conscripted black and white soldiers. And Nelson Mandela wanted to transition the South African military to more reflect modern South Africa. So when the United States sought to press President Mandela to get South Africa to sign up for an African 911 first responders unit, Nelson Mandela didn't want to do that. He wanted the transition to have time to succeed because he realized that transitioning the institutions of state, including the military, was vital to South Africa's stability and long-term performance. And we diplomats in South Africa told Washington, President Mandela doesn't want to do this. Do not come to South Africa to try to get South Africa to sign up for what was called the African Crisis Response Initiative. This was just after the massacre, the genocide in Rwanda, where the United States had sat on its hands while 800,000 Rwandans were chopped up by their neighbors. And so it's horrible. And so President Clinton wanted an African group to come together to respond first to humanitarian disasters. Secretary of State Warren Christopher, kind of a lawyerly policy wonk, came to South Africa to try to convince Nelson Mandela. And at the very last minute, I was invited in, sort of dragooned in, to be the note taker. Somebody else had missed the caravan that came over. And so they said, Ron, come in. You're taking notes. We were met. There were about five Americans that went in. And Nelson Mandela met us at the door of his office and said, hello, I'm Nelson Mandela, as if we wouldn't know who he was. And he chatted with all of the American visiting delegates, and including me. And he said, now, Ron, you're here at the Consulate General in Cape Town. How do you like Cape Town? I said, oh, it's great. We really enjoy it. He said, where are you from originally? I said, Iowa. He said, tell me about Iowa. I said, Iowa's got rich soil, great education, and nice people. He said, oh, well. And he visited with each of us a little bit. And at the same time, Warren Christopher, who had a plane to catch to Tanzania, kept moving towards the negotiation table, wanting to get to it. And as he, you know, literally walked towards the table, Nelson Mandela said, oh, I forgot, we have cookies. And he went and got a tray of cookies and brought everybody in the room a tray of cookies. So eventually we got over to the negotiating table, and Secretary Christopher was flustered. His time was running out. His plane was about to leave. He gave a hurried and not very convincing talk. And at the last minute, Nelson Mandela said, Secretary Christopher, thank you so much for coming by and explaining this complex, important issue. I'm going to have to discuss it in great length with my advisors. Thank you very much. I know you have a plane to catch. Let's step outside for a photo. And all the Americans were just beaming because Nelson Mandela had talked to them, served them a cookie, and clearly he had run out the clock on Secretary Christopher without ever saying no. Christopher knew he had been outfoxed, but all of the Americans went away feeling utmost admiration and warmth towards Nelson Mandela. So how to say no without burning bridges was one of Nelson Mandela's great, great interpersonal skills, and he used that continually. So, you know, not antagonizing people who you have to say no to. And he had to say no a lot as the new South Africa was being formed. Really a remarkable set of skills that he practiced with, the ultimate statecraft is what I saw.
And it sounds like he practiced it with a sense of humility and warmth.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest today is Ambassador Ron McMullen. He spent more than 30 years working in the U.S. Foreign Service and was stationed in South Africa when Nelson Mandela was president. We are spending some time this hour remembering Nelson Mandela and talking about his remarkable legacy. We will also meet some young professionals from Africa in just a few minutes. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This summer marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of Nelson Mandela, and this hour we're spending a little bit of time talking about Mandela's legacy and remembering him. Coming up in just a few minutes, I will talk with three young professionals from Africa who spent time in Iowa this summer as part of the Mandela Washington Fellowship Program, just a tiny part of the Mandela legacy. And with me right now is Ambassador Ron McMullen. He is the University of Iowa's ambassador in residence right now. He spent more than 30 years in the U.S. Foreign Service, and he was stationed in South Africa when Nelson Mandela was president. And we have just a few minutes left, Ron. You were talking earlier about how Nelson Mandela chose to just serve one term as president, but he potentially had so much power and so much goodwill in South Africa. Give me a little bit of your impression of what the people of South Africa felt about Nelson Mandela.
When he was elected in 1994, white South Africans, who make up about 10% of the population, were uncertain and stockpiled candles and beans and guns and ammunition in their basements, thinking that it might be an ethnic or racial war. Black South Africans were ecstatic and believed that maybe they would suddenly become rich and prosperous as well. So there were expectations that fears and hopes. The fears were not turned into reality, and many of the hopes also have somewhat faded in the decades since then. But when Mandela came in, the fact that he spoke with tones of reconciliation, fostered democracy, rule of law, and had wanted South Africa to join the liberal international order. It was really interesting that they, in power, he was not revolutionary. He was sort of status quo. Bernie Sanders came to South Africa during that time, and I met with, I was the note taker at Bernie Sanders' meeting with Thabo Mbeki, Nelson Mandela's deputy president. Thabo Mbeki, who had been thought to be a Marxist, argued very strongly about the benefits of capitalism and how South Africa needed to grow the pie. Bernie Sanders, the American member of Congress, talked about the benefits of socialism and how people who have been oppressed and without power or resources needed help. And I thought, what world am I in with Bernie Sanders and Thabo Mbeki taking this side? So Nelson Mandela has the legacy of democracy, rule of law, and encouraging and leading South Africa into what was at the time the growing democratic liberal international order. And it was at the time when the Soviet Union had dissolved, authoritarianism was falling, and democracy was on the rise around the world. And Nelson Mandela was both the leader and the perfect role model for that time when democracy, rule of law, and human rights seemed to be ascendant. Now, today, many people look at globalization and world capitalism causing ills that we're seeing a backlash now, not only in the United States, around the world, but also in South Africa. There's large economic inequality. There's a backlash towards globalization. There's increasing concern about ethnic and racial identity coming to the fore. And this is a global concern. And so it's really vital at this point in America's development as well as South Africa's development that we focus on Mandela's strong support for democracy, rule of law, and human rights as the way towards a better society for everyone.
People have been talking about Mandela's political legacy and about his focus on reconciliation and peace. How about his personal legacy? You talked about how he was as a man. I mean, what do you think we need to remember about this man?
He was a man of contradictions, an armed revolutionary, and a man who made peace. He was a man of great love and dedication to his wives. He had three of them. He also had many girlfriends along the way. He was a man who knew his stature, who had risen to the very top ranks of global leadership, came from very humble origins. So we can't think of Nelson Mandela as the Dalai Lama or Gandhi. He was a complicated man in the hurly-burly of politics, and yet remained true to his principles and his values.
Ambassador Ron McMullen, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, you're welcome, Debbie. Charity, anytime. Yeah.
Ambassador Ron McMullen, the ambassador in residence at the University of Iowa and former ambassador to Eritrea. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. We've been talking about the legacy of Nelson Mandela, and part of his legacy is a program that brings some of Africa's most promising young professionals to Iowa every summer as part of the Mandela Washington Fellowship Program run by the U.S. State Department. Both the University of Iowa and Drake University participate in the program. The fellows have left Iowa. They're spending time in Washington, D.C. now, but I had a chance to visit with three of them who spent time at the University of Iowa this summer. And we'll start right now with Luana Parada. I asked her to tell me where she's from.
I'm from Guinea-Bissau. It's a small country in the western side of Africa.
Right. And quite small, even by Iowa standards. This is just south of Senegal.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Just south of Senegal, we have, our population is 1.7 million. And many are foreigners, so we aren't doing much of a good job being growing.
So you come from a very small country, and right now you're working for a non-governmental organization, and part of your responsibility is assisting with communication,
yes,
and youth and civic duty. You also,
exactly,
I hear, spend a little time in radio broadcasting,
yes,
as well.
Yes, I did.
Tell me about that.
About the radio broadcasting?
Yeah.
Great. The organization I work for has a group of youngsters. They volunteer in environmental protection and also in civic duty, active civic duty, making young people believe that they can be the change in their country. So the best way to reach people in Guinea-Bissau is through radio, because internet and television are not very developed. The program is produced and broadcasted by youngsters. It comes out once a week, 1 hour, but I think it's important because it's a space where you get to hear about what young people are doing through young people's voices. So it's something that is usually not done in Guinea-Bissau. And when it first started, it was completely new because we didn't even have a youth-managed radio. Now it's more common. You have more programs focused on young people, on young people's activities. But still, Inter Jovens is the name of the program. It's very popular. We open the mic every week for 10 to 20 minutes. And it's amazing the amount of people who calls us just to say, we love what you're doing, just keep up, keep the good job, keep doing it. And it's great because they don't call only from Bissau, the capital. They also call from inner regions where you wouldn't expect them to be listening to what we're doing. So it's good. We're actually giving a voice to those people as well.
Well, and that's kind of an offshoot of the organization you work for. Tell me about the focus of the organization.
Tinigena, which means this land is ours, focuses on sustainable development and also on environmental protection. The organization believes that development cannot happen if at the cost of our environment. So we try to balance that in a poor developing country where most people still live without electricity, without water, and, you know, trying to make them believe that you should not ruin your forests, you should not ruin your rivers for electricity. There's a way of having both. That's basically what we do. We try to engage the population in the development process, because our government is not a very active, not a very reliable one. It's a peculiar country. And it's basically what we do. We have a few projects where we try to empower women through agriculture, education, and also through knowledge of the law. Most of them just don't know what they can do. We also have many projects where we try to give resources and more knowledge to agricultures, to farmers, because agriculture is the main income source of our country. So that's what we do.
What made you want to apply for the Mandela Fellowship?
For the Mandela Fellowship? Mm-hmm. I'm always trying to improve myself, and the fellowship seemed like a good opportunity. I was anxious to come and get to know a new country, to meet new people. And especially for that, for the people I was going to meet in here.
And what are you hoping to do with the skills that you've learned during the fellowship? What's your 5-year goal?
Pass them on. Mostly that, pass on the knowledge. The youth association I volunteer for, we have constant programs where, apart from the radio program, we also give workshops. We prepare long-term activities where the young people just be able to be engaged and do something by themselves, where they get to learn and feel that they are being successful. So I'll try to pass the knowledge and also invest in my own business. I think 5 years is a good time to try and get my company running.
What are you hoping to do with your company?
It's a media agency, a communication agency, focused mostly on marketing services. I want to give life to it. It already exists. It used to be a publishing agency my parents own, but publishing isn't really doing it anymore back home, so I wanted to give life to it, bring it to life.
Now, Iowa is a small state, and you're from a small country. I have a feeling that we have a problem in common, and that's, I suspect it's difficult to keep educated, talented individuals like yourself in your country. Do you have a problem with people once they get an education leaving?
Yes, that's the biggest problem. Most people are forced to go get their education outside in another country, and most of them do not come back. But personally speaking, I love the country, so even though I'm always going away, I plan on coming back.
Yeah, why is that so important to you?
Because I truly believe that we have to operate the change. It must come from the inside. International aid doesn't really help us. It's not something that will help us progress. It just keeps us going on a daily basis, and that's not development. That's not sustainable. And also because I seriously love the country. I love the fact that it's warm and humid. It's more humid than Iowa, believe me.
Well, yeah, tell me a little bit about it, because, again, this is a country that most of our listeners are not going to even have heard of before. Tell me what it's like there.
Everyone is pretty relaxed. Everyone is pretty laid back. There's no hurry to do anything. We have 87 islands, of which only 21 are inhabited. And they asked me why. I said, for religious reasons. The ethnical group that lives in those islands believes that you should leave space for the gods to develop. So those are the islands are God's space.
They're sacred islands.
Yes, they're sacred islands. They're used only for religious ceremonies or every now and then for agriculture. But most of the time they're over there. Actually, all of the islands are considered a national patrimony, biosphere patrimony, because since they don't touch it, they don't use it, everything's pretty much intact, be it animals, be it ecosystems, be it plants. So it's a pretty cool place. They have good beaches.
Nice. And rare to find wilderness that's untouched like that.
Yes, it's rare to find. And now it's getting harder and harder to keep it that way, because with development, people have other expectations. They don't want to just live under the palm tree and drink palm wine every day. They want other things. And they're going to the other islands. A lot of foreign influence as well. But I think it's only bad because the government does not have a good judiciary system. If the law worked, people would work for the best because they knew they would be punished if they weren't doing a good job. It doesn't work, unfortunately, but we are doing our best.
It sounds like you spend a lot of time communicating with young people and trying to give them a vision for the future. What do you try to teach them?
Well, first I try to teach them that they should do it by themselves. There's no need to wait for someone else to do it, to help you with it. Second, I try to promote education. We give English lessons, we give Portuguese lessons, we also give workshops mostly on handiwork, so they can pay for their studies if they want to do higher education, if they want to go for higher education. And also try to give them hope. Before coming here, we had the opportunity to talk on a few radio programs about the Mandela Washington Fellowship. And most people just asked, how can we apply? Is it possible for us to be chosen? And my answer is always the same. Yes, you just have to work on yourself. You have to improve your skills. Go learn English. Go do social activities. Go and be productive and apply. Reapply. If you don't do it the first time, you'll win.
Do you also encourage young people to stay in the country?
We try to, but it's a personal choice, and it's a hard subject, because it's easy to say you should stay here when I'm living comfortably in the country. So I understand that people want to go, and it's fair. Sometimes they go and it helps them realize that they were better back home. So if they want to go, we just encourage them to go legally. We just encourage them to go legally and go ready. They should know that when they're in a foreign country, life will not be easier. They will still have to work. They will still have to suffer through. Life is not easy. It doesn't matter which country you're in.
What do you think you'll take away from your time in Iowa this summer?
I think mostly the relations. The experience in general has been great, but the relations, I get along pretty much well with the other fellows. And there are many projects that we can do together. Collaboration, collaboration, collaboration. That's the focus. It's basically it.
Well, and earlier, Charles mentioned that a lot of people in medical fields came to Iowa City because, of course, that's a resource that we have here. Why do you think Iowa was your destination?
Well, I still do not know. I still do not know, and I've asked around what are the criteria to send people to different cities? Mm-hmm. Because it's 700 of us, so how do they choose? And I still do not know the answer. I'm just glad to be here because it's a very welcoming city. Iowa, nice. It's a very welcoming city, and also I love the fellows I'm with, the Institute, TP Business, College of Business. It's a great place. The instructors are also great, and I'm pleased to be here, but I do not know why.
What was your reaction when you found out you were coming to Iowa?
Where is Iowa?
Yeah.
Wikipedia.
Thank goodness for the internet, right? Luana Pereira, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much, Charity.
Luana Pereira of Guinea-Bissau. It's a small country in Western Africa, just south of Senegal. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we've been talking about the legacy of Nelson Mandela, and I am in the midst of meeting some of the Mandela Washington Fellows, who are part of the Mandela Washington Fellowship Program run by the U.S. State Department. It brings some of Africa's most promising young professionals to Iowa. It has been for the last several summers. And with me now is Charles Fall. He is from Johannesburg, South Africa. He studied software development at Nelson Mandela University and is currently completing a Master's of Science in Biotechnology. Charles, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, with the fellowship program, there always needs to be a problem that you've identified that you're hoping to work on in the future. What is the problem you identified?
Well, actually, about a year ago, we started working on a specific problem, which was medical diagnostics throughout Africa. And it started with the Ebola outbreak and the fact that there was a severe lack of laboratories that were capable of assisting and analyzing samples for the Ebola crisis. And one of the key things was that samples had to be transported to a central laboratory facility and then analyzed. So we took the approach of decentralizing pathology laboratories, and we came up with a lab in a box that uses a very powerful diagnostic method and can allow medical practitioners to actually test for viruses in the field.
Describe it for me, a lab in a box. How big a box are we talking about? What's in there?
Your average briefcase, basically. And then inside that briefcase, we've got what's called a molecular diagnostic workflow. So basically, we take a blood sample, we process the blood sample, we then analyze the blood sample, specifically at a DNA level, and then look for the target DNA, which would then be from the virus, and output the results, and we guide the medical practitioner through the process using a touch interface that we've developed. We're currently building more prototypes. It takes a lot to get this kind of thing to market. We've also included something, things that usually you wouldn't think about including, which is an air filtration system and a sterile work area. So the entire box becomes essentially a briefcase that you fold open, and you've got a tiny little lab that you can use to process blood samples. Currently, we're working on processing 9 samples at a time. We'll upscale that, of course, as we go further. And we're hoping that eventually we'll be able to do about 96 samples at a time.
Sounds like really an incredible plan and something that could save a lot of lives. What led you to apply for the Mandela Fellowship? I mean, you have an idea and you have a prototype. What made you want to be part of this program?
Well, we actually won quite a few competitions with our prototypes and stuff, and we raised some capital. And with that came the issue of needing access to more knowledge, more diverse knowledge networks, and so on. And we were approached by the Canadian Red Cross, who is now working with us on the project and will be assisting us in actually testing the device. We also work with UNICEF on the project through Rhodes University. And with the Mandela Washington Fellowship, the benefit that I saw there was that I can start speaking to people in the same line of work that I am in and develop networks that will allow me to take it further, take it throughout Africa, because Africa can be a very difficult place to do business in when it comes to these kinds of things. You've got a lot of hurdles with regards to regulation and government and people not generally understanding regulation a lot of the time. So to try and implement something like this, you need experienced people, you need people in the field that understand the problems. So we work with the Red Cross to better understand what they require from such a device. And they also work with people in these countries. And subsequently, we get a very good overview. And being here has put me into touch with a lot of people that have ground-level knowledge and that can actually assist in taking it forward. And then, of course, I've offered my services as well to everybody here that we're all trying to work together. And it's one thing that for me has been beneficial and what I kind of expected from the fellowship is to bring Africa together, to actually work together, to pass on knowledge and to increase power and manufacturing within Africa. So my company has I suppose you could call it a somewhat corny slogan, which is innovation in Africa for Africa. And that's what we stand for. And that's what this program will definitely assist me in doing.
Well, and you mentioned the Ebola crisis, and I can imagine this kind of tool being incredibly valuable in a situation like that. But it seems like the applications would be far-reaching. What other applications do you see for this?
One of the big applications for this is, of course, HIV viral load testing. So in order to actually treat a patient correctly and to dose them correctly with antiretrovirals, you need to know what their viral load count is. And our device can actually do that as well. Then beyond that, it can be used for epidemiological studies. So we're actually looking at adding Zika virus as one of them because it's from Zaire. It's a little bit of a confusion. A lot of people think Zika originated from South America. It actually comes from Africa. And then there's some other hemorrhagic fevers and stuff as well that also need to be tracked. And beyond that, there's a very simple thing which the Red Cross has been very adamant on is actually using it to differentiate between viral infections and bacterial infections in order to better implement antibiotic regimes and prevent antibiotic resistance from building up in populations.
What was your reaction when you learned that you were coming to Iowa? I know there are Mandela fellows all over the country. So what was your response?
I actually didn't really respond immediately.
Because you had to look it up?
Yes. So I base my opinions on data. So I had to actually go and look at it. I saw that clearly there was a differentiation that they did because we have a lot of medical people within our cohort here. Mm-hmm. And we've got a lot of agricultural people. So they seem to have done it appropriate to that. And the experience here has been fantastic. I love it. I come from a small university town, actually the same town as Jolene. We both went to Rhodes University in South Africa, and it's also a small town, university town. So, I think it was very exciting once we actually landed and then saw how it was.
Right, but, so Iowa City feels very familiar.
Yeah, definitely.
What do you think you'll take away? What's the best thing you'll take away from this experience?
Networking and developing a more global mindset within Africa and also just communicating and working with fellow Africans, primarily for me.
Charles, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Charles Fall is from Johannesburg, South Africa. He has developed a lab in a box and is hoping to address medical diagnosis problems around Africa. And now we turn to our final Mandela Fellow of the day. Joylene Kafuka is from Harare, Zimbabwe. She's a pharmacist who's worked mostly in a private hospital setting, but she has a strong interest in health education in the community. Joylene, tell me, what took you down the path of becoming a pharmacist?
Well, that's an interesting story. So when I finished high school, I knew I always wanted to be involved in health. So when I finished high school, I wanted to be a medical doctor, but not just any medical doctor. I needed to specialize. So I really was interested in neurosurgery. So when the grades came out, I didn't make the grades for medical school. But I think about 8 months later, then they said, actually, that grade is acceptable as well. But then I thought, goodness gracious, that's 9 years of being poor. So I said, okay, maybe I can take a different path. So my friend was doing pharmacy at Rhodes University, and that's where I went. And yeah, it's been good.
So working as a pharmacist, what made you decide to apply for this fellowship program? What are you looking for?
Okay, so working as a pharmacist, one thing that I realized or I've seen is that medication becomes more and more expensive as the years go by. And in Zimbabwe, access is not that great. So you have people that, you know, just don't have access to the medication that they need to, you know, keep disease at bay, so to speak. So one of my focuses is health education so that you don't have to depend so much on medication.
Is there something specific that you've seen that you really want to help with?
Yes. So looking at diabetes and hypertension, because more often than not, those are lifestyle diseases. So just changing your lifestyle, eating healthier, exercising can reverse even some of those conditions. So that's what made me interested in taking advantage of the Mandela Washington Fellowship to see how other people are doing it in Iowa. Yes.
And so when you talk about a lack of access being a problem, you mentioned cost.
Yes.
So people can't afford the medication that they need.
Yes.
But I suspect that the access problem is bigger than that. What are some of the other barriers?
Okay, so we manufacture probably about 5% of the medication that we use in Zimbabwe, and the rest is imported. And with the way the economy's been doing recently, importing that medication has not been easy. And it's becoming more expensive. So that's the access problem that I've seen as well.
What is your hope? I know that everyone who comes to the fellowship has a five-year plan, a goal for the future. What is your goal?
My goal is to actually set up lifestyle centers all over Zimbabwe and have medical tourism where people from outside of Zimbabwe come in and access those services that I'll be offering, which is pretty much lifestyle coaching. You know, when people have to start taking medication, no one coaches them on how to do that or how to make this new habit, you know, part of your life.
So you're hoping to attract people from outside Zimbabwe?
Yes.
Why is that an important part of the puzzle?
Well, I suppose just looking at it from the economical side of things, if somebody is coming into the country to access, say, my services or other industries benefit. If it's tourism, that's another industry that benefits because we have one of the seven wonders of the world, which is the Victoria Falls, mm-hmm. You know. So tourism does well for any economy. So those are some of my thought processes.
What was your reaction when you found out that you were coming to Iowa?
I was actually pretty excited. I've been to the States about three times and I've never been to the Midwest. And the fact that it's in the summer, because I thought I'd never come to the States in the summer because it's so hot.
You are blowing a stereotype a lot of people in Iowa have about Africa if you're complaining about our heat.
Oh, yeah. We live in a very temperate region. It's the temperature doesn't go above 34. No, probably 100 or, yeah, it doesn't go above 100 or 95.
All right.
Yeah. So, and it's not humid. So.
Well.
Yeah.
So you were excited, but you didn't know about our summers?
Yes. So when we got here, when we got here, it was raining. And when we walked out, because everything is pretty much air conditioned here. Mm-hmm. So when you walk out, then it hits you that actually, it's summertime here. The humidity and the heat, and even though it's cloudy, but it's still so balmy hot. So I think that was the one thing that. But it was a great. It was great to experience that.
What do you think you'll take away from your time in Iowa? The most important thing you'll take away from here?
I think it's the community aspect of the way things happen in Iowa. I mean, the volunteering that we've been doing over these past few weeks has really blown me away. We were with Hannah today. She's a high school student. And she said, I just really like to be able to help others. And it's not something that you find very much in Africa, unfortunately. And so and the one thing I learned today, I think that's probably going to be one of my biggest takeaways.
And today was a service day.
Yes, exactly. Because there is the North Liberty Community Pantry gets produce from, hang on, I just need to read it, a community-supported agriculture. Mm-hmm. And people buy shares to, you know, at least get fresh produce. And it's something that we don't do at home. And so that's definitely something I'm taking away to do. Because even in lifestyle change, eating healthy and eating fresh, eating from the ground, from farm to table, is really important. So that's one thing I'm definitely
excited
going
about
to do. Yes.
That's fantastic.
Yes.
What do you think in visiting with business leaders and going to different places around the state, is there a skill that you think you've been able to acquire that you'll be able to take home to hopefully help your dream come true?
I think this is probably just one story that we listened to. When was it? On Wednesday night. That was Mandela Day. Yes. And I think it was Ambassador
McMillan,
yes. When he told the story of how Nelson Mandela would say no without burning bridges, which I thought was awesome. And so there'll be things that come across or opportunities maybe, or people that you might be working with or you come across that way. There are times that it's not the right time to do something, but you don't need to burn bridges with that particular person, because down the line you might need them, they might need you, and you don't. So diplomatically being able to say no.
That sounds like an incredible skill, something I need to practice. Well,
yes.
And after you leave Iowa, you'll spend a few days in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
And then you head back home.
Yes.
Are there opportunities to follow up with the people that you've met here and the things that you've learned here after you get back home?
Yes, they are. And I think that's the one thing that Dimi Doreska, our director here, has been very good about, and he's been talking about a lot, that, you know, we've created a new family, or we've made a new family here. And anytime we need anything, you know, we can just drop an email or a phone call. And I know they're going to be coming out to some of the countries in Africa to see some projects or form new partnerships. And with our mentors as well, we'll definitely always be in touch. So
this is something that continues.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, Joylene,
and we'll probably be back.
Yeah, we'd love to see you again. Joylene Kafuka, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was really great to be here.
Joylene Kafuka is from Harare, Zimbabwe. She is hoping to establish lifestyle health centers, which would benefit both high and low income communities in Zimbabwe, hopefully bring people in from out of the country as well. She is a pharmacist right now. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.